This is the Championship Chat Podcast, your home of news, views and debate from England's second tier.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Championship Chat Podcast, sponsored by Cards Accepted. I'm Elliot Jackson and I'm rejoined as always by my co-host George Smith. Hello George, how are you? How many Easter eggs have you eaten this week?
Not many, being honest. I only got a couple this year. I've let myself down there. I was too invested in the football instead of chocolate. So I think it was a worthy alternative, to be fair, because the Easter weekend lived up to expectations. Good Friday, though, a little bit flat, but my word, Easter Monday, that lived up to the billing. Certainly in the late afternoon, in the early evening, goodness me.
Well, you may have not been diving into the sweet treats, but it has been a feast of football in the Championship with two match days on Friday and then, of course, on Monday. Plenty of drama at both ends of the table. And we're going to try and bring you a summary of what's gone on and what's changed in the last 7 days. Apologies early on. I am a little bit under the weather, so if I sound a bit nasally and bunged up, you'll just have to cope for an hour. But plenty of exciting football to distract you from that. I think the best place to start, as we always do, is with the latest managerial news in the Championship, and that is that Plymouth Argyle have parted company with Ian Foster, with the Argyle one place and 1 point above the bottom three. It was eight defeats in 11 games for Plymouth under Ian Foster, of course losing both games over the Easter weekend. And for an Argyle team and an Argyle, you know, management board structure that is so well known for the processes. And let's remember, this was not a rushed appointment by any means. Stephen Schumacher left them at the altar in December, probably around the 12th of December, I think it was, off the top of my head. And Ian Foster was not appointed until just shy of a month later. So it was very clearly communicated by those that ran this process that Foster came out fantastically in the data against all of their metrics. They had some good candidates for the job, but he was the one they plumped for. And of course, it was his first proper post in management, having worked very closely with the England youth groups. But at club level, this was a first toe dipped in the water, having been working in Saudi Arabia with Steven Gerrard at the time. And it has gone pretty disastrously in truth. And I'm always reticent to draw too many conclusions and to praise clubs for making managerial changes after 11, 12, 15, 20, even, you know, half a season. It's not long enough. I think managers need at least a season, deserve a pre-season. If you are committed to your processes and committed to ensuring your club is sustainable and that you're looking at medium and long-term visions as well as adhering to the short-term, then it's integral, in my opinion, that you give your managers time. However, I don't think you can sit here and say that this is not the right decision from Plymouth Argyle, because it had got so toxic. He was not a well-liked man at Home Park. The supporters didn't like how he'd handled himself in the media, his abrasive demeanour at times. And he simply wasn't getting results. You know, 8 defeats in 11 is pretty damning. And I think the biggest issue, without a shadow of a doubt, George, was the home form, because they were so good under Schumacher and even Ryan Lowe before that at Home Park. That was what was keeping them up when they were, you know, 16th in the table, 15th in the table. They'd picked up, you know, 70, 80% of their points had come at Home Park. Well, in their last 5 games, they've lost them all at home to nil. And ultimately, you can be rubbish away from home, but if you are still producing the goods in front of the bulk of your supporters, who might not be as diehard as those that travel across the country, you'll probably get away with it for a certain amount of time. But if you are not appeasing those that are paying their season ticket prices, you're on a hide into nothing. He never really got that relationship or built that bond with the fans. And I find it very hard, despite my general beliefs about management and how to succeed in the Championship, find it very hard to sit here and say that this wasn't a necessary decision from Plymouth Argyle.
Yeah, it felt inevitable for a few weeks, didn't it? And I think the biggest indicator of that was the way that the Plymouth Argyle fans were pretty frustrated and not liking the way he was speaking in the media. As you said, it was a lot of comparisons with the way Mick Beale's short time at Sunderland panned out, really, in truth. To be fair, it was very, very similar in the sense that the fans were not liking what he was saying to the press. And ultimately, it was one of those situations where it needed to change sooner rather than later, not just because of that relationship with the fans, but because Plymouth Argyle's championship status is on the line here, they are in trouble at the moment. Like you said, it's been a really, really sharp slide that they've been on. And I think you've hit the nail on the head with the statistic that you mentioned at the very end, and I was going to raise it myself if you didn't, was the fact that they've gone five home games without even scoring a goal. When you consider just how good Plymouth were at home under Stephen Schumacher, that's a very, very alarming statistic. And I think one of the most amazing statistics of them all is the fact, which shows just how good they were at home under Stephen Schumacher, is that they still have got the fifth best home attack in the league this season. And they've gone five games without scoring at home, Park. The last time they scored at home was the 14th of February, which is nearly obviously 2 months ago as we record this. So it's felt like a change that had to be made. Ultimately, as soon as the reports came out on a couple of hours after the game with Bristol City had finished on Easter Monday, it came out for, I think it was the Telegraph or the Times that reported that he was on the brink of leaving that post. And automatically, like so many others, I just thought, Neil Warnock, it's just going to be Neil Warnock, isn't it? He lives that way. It's that his neck of the woods. Six games to go. It would be the dream
on,
scenario.
Darren, one
it?
Last gig. Six
one
games.
Last gig. One last gig. Literally, it's a short one, this one. I'll only be away for like, you know, 6 weeks. That's all
he wouldn't
it's going
even
to take
be away.
Time.
He wouldn't have to commute.
No, he wouldn't.
Like, last gig. Just
around
home.
The corner, this one. Around the corner. But no, I think, obviously, they've gone with the director of football, Neil Dewsnip. He obviously knows the club inside out. He admitted, I think, in his press conference yesterday, I think it was, which was Wednesday as we record this, that he felt almost as though he let Ian Foster down a little bit because he was involved in the recruitment process of bringing him in, and said he was quite disappointed, naturally, that it had not worked out. And at the time, a lot of Plymouth fans did say when he was appointed, it felt like he ticked a lot of boxes for the Plymouth model, a forward-thinking young coach to progress in the same way Ryan Lowe did initially in his career. Stephen Schumacher did the same. But ultimately, it's not worked out. And I must admit, from looking from afar, obviously not as a Plymouth Argyle fan, he wasn't saying the right things in the media. He was talking situations down and he seemed almost oblivious of what was going on around him with the attitude of the supporters towards him who were screaming for him to go 4 weeks ago. So it is quite surprising that he lasted this long. And ultimately, like you said, we generally are in favour, both of us, of managers getting time to implement their ideas and their vision. But 17 matches was all he lasted. He lost nine of those, winning just four. That's in all competitions, including, I think, two FA Cup games because they drew at Leeds and then needed a replay. And ultimately, it's cost him his job. And it is kind of weird because initially he got off to quite a bright start, Ian Foster. I think he won two of his first four league games in charge. Things were going quite well. But since, say, the middle of February, things have really started to slide, and that is why they're in the position that they're in now with six games to go, 1 point and one place above the dreaded bottom three. So a lot of work to be done, but it just feels as though now that Ian Foster is out the door, the mood around that football club has instantly been lifted. There was so much toxicity towards that guy that the fans were just in a position where we can't take this anymore. We need to do something with someone else. And ultimately, they've got a guy now who knows the club inside out. He's already there. He knows the players. They know him. And just with a little bit of confidence injected back into that group, we know, we've seen from Plymouth enough times this season that they have got enough quality to stay in this division. They've already mapped out a plan to get to the Premier League in terms of the next 5 years or so, stabilised in the Championship, then trying to take that next step. And right at the very beginning of the season, if you think back, I never considered Plymouth for relegation when they first got promoted. So I think that would have been the case had Stephen Schumacher not been extracted and taken to Stoke. So hopefully they can find a way to get the job done. Six crucial games coming up. Massive game at Rotherham United on Friday night, tomorrow as we record this.
That is it's one the that they, definition of a six-pointer.
It's a huge one. And then I think they've got QPR next week as well and Leicester. Still so they really need to make the most of this
well
game with Rotherham.
Before the end of the season.
So some big old games coming up, but you know, Plymouth from their perspective, they've got the injection of confidence that they needed, certainly in the fans' eyes anyway, because this situation with Ian Foster couldn't continue. So time will tell, but I think now that he's gone, Plymouth fans will be a lot more optimistic about staying up than if he was still in charge.
It's a surprise really that they didn't make the change after the Norwich game, albeit losing at Norwich is not particularly that damning, but you just think, given the strength of feeling from the supporters, actually they probably could have maybe got a result, Bristol City at home. That could have been quite a nice fixture to come off the back of what would have been a morale-boosting decision to let Ian Foster go. But I think ultimately, as someone that does work in, obviously, covering a football club for local media, as I do for Blackburn Rovers, I think that it can be really underestimated by some managers how important your relationship with the media is. And I don't mean with me in that or in with the reporter, but I mean using the reporters and the independent media to get your message out there, to make sure that you are saying the right things so that the fans can build that connection. Because if fans are reading articles that are put out by reporters who, you know, don't have, you know, aren't there to toe the party line, they're there to report and be apply scrutiny to the football club. If things aren't going your way and you're coming across as either overly abrasive or you're coming across as playing down the situation too much, it can irritate supporters. And once you lose the fan base in the way that Foster did, it can be really, really difficult to get them back. Ultimately, I say all that, but the main thing that matters is results on the pitch. And if you're not getting those, then you're going to ultimately be on a hiding to nothing as it stands. We'll come back on to Plymouth Argyle when we go to the bottom of the table and talk through all of the action that's gone on there. But let's turn our attention now to the top of the table. And what a weekend for one team in particular chasing the dream to the Premier League, George. And that is Ipswich Town. Now, funnily enough, I actually think Ipswich probably only deserved 1 point from their two games over the Easter weekend. But they've taken all six. I watched them, obviously. I was at Ewood Park on Friday where they played Blackburn Rovers and played pretty well in the first half, but I thought second half they dropped off, and I thought Rovers deserved a point. I thought they were quite unlucky with some of the refereeing decisions, and they created enough chances to take something from that game. That said, again, Ipswich showing their quality, digging in. Likely made a couple of good saves, a couple of decisions went in their way, as I say. On to the Southampton game, and again, I thought Southampton were probably the better team over the 90 minutes. They certainly had periods, probably midway through the first half, to the start of the sort of midway through the second half, where Southampton were completely on top. And as I say, I watched all the extended highlights and I listened to the entirety of the second half on the radio on my drive back from the Stadium of Light on Easter Monday. But they just know how to wrestle back control, don't they, Ipswich? And they know how to get themselves back in games, and they've just got that knack of getting over the line. And we've said it before, but these moments that they keep creating, you talk the Bristol City game, immediately springs to mind. This one, I know you've put some stats on the podcast page this week about Ipswich's love for a goal in stoppage time. But it's that never say die attitude and those intangible qualities where when you've not been at your best, grinding out the result, whether that's to win the game as they seem to keep doing at Portman Road, or whether that's to keep the opposition out after scoring early away from home as they did at Ewood Park. So although I don't think Ipswich have been at their best over the Easter weekend, they have picked up six massive points. And as it stands, they are the Championship League leaders, which is just a phenomenal achievement. And in the week where the EFL have released their nominees for manager of the season, I don't think there's any doubt in either of our minds that no matter what happens in this next 6 weeks, Kieran McKenna should walk that nomination, and he should rightly will be Championship manager of the season, and thoroughly deservedly so. For them to be on 87 points with six games left to play is absolutely mental.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it? Really, it is just staggering what they've achieved. I don't think there's any limits to this Ipswich Town team. The belief, the mentality of that group is just, it's off the scale, isn't it? It's absolutely remarkable. But first things first, I didn't see the Blackburn game last Friday, apart from the last 5-10 minutes. I saw the game against Southampton in full. Brilliant game, brilliant advert for the Championship yet again. And I agree with you. I thought for long periods of the game, certainly up to probably the 70th minute, Southampton were the better team. I thought in the first half they played some really, really nice stuff. Don't get me wrong, Ipswich came flying out the traps, got that early goal through Leif Davis, and at that point you thought, here we go, they're at it again. But then Southampton obviously came roaring back with those couple of goals from Shea Adams and Adam Armstrong. But then Ipswich did an Ipswich, didn't they? It's as simple as that. That is what they do. They fight back. And being the sad football statistical nerd that I am, I actually jotted down a few weeks ago and working out a series of stats for the Twitter page. And I will hold the piece of paper up to show you as proof here.
Jesus,
what? This is the number of points for the top three teams in each Championship season that have recovered points from losing positions since 2004-05. Only in Championship history has one team taken more points than Ipswich from a losing position, and that was Blackpool in 2011-12. They won 32 points from losing positions. Ipswich have won 31 now. Ipswich have won 24 points from losing positions at home this season. Nobody in Championship history since the restructure in 04-05 has ever won more. They're only the third team in Championship history to have won 30 points or more from losing positions. That is a sign.
So you've got Blackpool,
Burnley, Burnley in 2010-11 got 30. Blackpool 32 in 11-12. And now, obviously, Ipswich in 23-24 with
that
a
was
whopping
the second
31.
Burnley team that went up, wasn't it, under Sean Dyche?
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, so Ipswich now have achieved 31 points from losing positions. And when I actually jotted down this piece of paper, Ipswich had won 25 from losing positions, which shows in about 3 weeks they've been at it again. But away from the comeback ability, the way they did it on Monday was just phenomenal. Jeremy Sarmiento, that moment, that goal feels like it could be a moment that takes Ipswich over the line. Last week on this podcast, you put me on the spot and asked for a top two to get promoted in no particular order. And I went for Leeds and Ipswich. I'm sticking with that. I genuinely just think it is written for Ipswich to get themselves over the line. And
oh,
like
I hope
said,
so, because it's in the world of parachute stage, payments and distorted leagues, it would be a great, great story if Ipswich. Don't get me wrong, there's been investment, there's been money spent at Ipswich, but to do back-to-back promotions in the way they have against the parachute clubs and to amass the points they have would be a phenomenal story.
There's got to be investments for you to realistically compete at Championship level, but they've not been sort of off-the-scale wild investments. They've invested wisely. They've not
Their January window is aging better and better.
They've not sort of chucked, say, 10 million at one player. They've spent maybe 1.5, 1.2, small amounts, but spent it wisely, invested well. Yes, they've spent money. Nobody's denying that. But if you look at that team that Kieran McKenna for the bulk of the season has played with, how many of those players got them out of League One last season?
I think the best example probably of what you're talking about is they invested £1 million in Leif Davis from Leeds United in League One.
And he's now probably worth...
It raised a lot of eyebrows, didn't it? Especially for the salary. Yeah. But as you say, he's now got, what, 16 assists, is it now, in the Championship?
16 assists and a couple of goals. It's unbelievable.
He's been the best left-back in the Championship by a country mile.
And obviously, when you look at Ipswich, and you mentioned there Leif Davis, I mean, when the time comes for us to pick our team of the seasons, we might as well just decide the left-back between us now, because I think that's fairly obvious.
Yeah.
But when you look at Ipswich, a lot of the focus, a lot of the time, say, is on Leif Davis, Kiefer Moore, Connor Chaplin, Amari Hutchinson, your goal scorers, your creators, players like that. But so much credit is owed to Sam Morsy and Massimo Luongo at the base of that midfield. Those two have been absolutely outstanding this season. Massimo Luongo picked up on a free transfer in January last year when Ipswich were pushing for promotion from League One. He's got to be one of the best free signings that any club's made in the last 5 years. He's been magnificent. Sam Morsy alongside him.
Middlesbrough for about
he did.
A season and didn't kick a ball.
He did. In September 22, I think he went there after he'd been without a club for a while after leaving Sheffield Wednesday. But he's been magnificent under Kieran McKenna. Then you look at that Ipswich bench that Kieran McKenna named on Monday. Harry Clark, he was in League One with them last season. Jack Taylor was playing League One football with Peterborough. Ali Alhamadi was playing with Wimbledon this season. Nathan Broadhead played in League One. Marcus Harness played in League One. These are not sort of massive names that have been signed for mega, mega books. Kieran McKenna, bottom line is, he's a bloody good manager. It's as simple as that. He's proven it this season, and whether Ipswich go up or not, like you said, that Manager of the Season award, it's his. There's no question. As much as I rate Daniel Farker and the job he's done at Leeds United this season, and a lot of people say, yeah, but he had parachute payments, this, that, and the other. Absolutely he did. But look at the squad he inherited, the amount of turnover that needed to be done, the players he had to shift before he could bring in. You know, Daniel Farker's done a good job, but Kieran McKenna, goodness me, it's unbelievable. So I look at this title race now, and it's going to be a thrilling race to the finish. Leicester, we'll talk about. They, of course, have got a game in hand on both Leeds and Ipswich. So ultimately, it's in Leicester's hands, though they're third at the moment. But I just think Ipswich are destined to do it. I just think it's one of those stories where you sort of think about it, and it just feels like every week they're ticking off a box to get themselves one step closer. Against Southampton, you thought, oh, they're going to drop a couple of points here, advantage Leeds and Leicester again. Sarmiento, you think the chance is gone, and he manages to poke it in. So, massive result for them. But like you said, Southampton, though of course the red card did influence things for James Bree, I thought over the course of the 90 minutes, I can see why the referee's given it. I think it's one of those where if it was one of your players, you're feeling aggrieved.
Holland Ellis is very close. I appreciate that you're not meant, that the covering defender doesn't matter that much if you're going to get your shot away, but I thought Holland Ellis was very close to
sending. Yeah, he was, but I can see why the referee's given it. Sort of in the heat of the moment, we haven't got VAR at this level and this, that and the other, but overall, I think Russell Martin can be quite pleased with the way that his team played. I would suggest now it is probably game over for the top two for Southampton. I know they've still got a couple of games in hand, but I think it's going to be a tall order purely because of the relentlessness and the pace that Leeds and Ipswich are both setting. So I don't know about you, but I'm sticking with that prediction of Leeds and Ipswich in no particular order because I don't know. But I think those two will be the ones to grab those two automatic spots.
It was a very damaging weekend for Southampton, who of course dropped 2 points on Friday as well with a 90th minute equaliser from Middlesbrough, Emmanuel Latelaf. And I think that puts them out of the top two race. Because had Southampton gone and beaten Ipswich, they would have obviously gone a lot closer. They'd have reduced the gap from, 12 points to 6 between them and Ipswich. They would have had two games in hand, and they would have had Leeds and Leicester still to play. And therefore, really, if Southampton, before Easter Monday, Southampton basically, if they'd won every game, they'd have probably still got in the top two. So I was really up for that, but having lost in the dramatic way they have, I think they're out of it now, personally. And it'll be interesting to see how they cope in the next few weeks, because although Russell Martin's saying that he still thinks he can get top two, I don't think so, personally. And they're definitely not going to fall out of the playoff places. So they're in that weird juxtaposition where kind of Middlesbrough were last season, and we saw how Middlesbrough struggled to turn it back on for the playoffs. And they're more than likely going to be playing West Brom's Carlos Corberan's West Brom, which is not going to be an easy game. So I'm intrigued to see how Southampton go over the next few weeks. Leicester, they took 3 points over the weekend. It got off to a disastrous start, obviously kicking off the weekend with the 12:30 kickoff on Friday, losing 1-0 to Bristol City. I've seen quite a bit of revisionism on this game, and I think it's worth remembering that Leicester absolutely should have been ahead in this game before Bristol City got anywhere near their goal. Jamie Vardy missed some really big chances. Probably the worst of the lot was the one where Zach Viner passed it straight to him and O'Leary pulled off a phenomenal save, in fairness. Max O'Leary's actually had a really decent season, and I was really unconvinced when he came into the goal last January when they saw Daniel Bentley. I couldn't believe they didn't sign a goalkeeper in the summer. But he's actually had a decent season, O'Leary, and he's certainly shown more consistent levels than I saw from him last season that he can be a championship goalkeeper. But yeah, I think the biggest concern for Leicester with that game for me was not how they played for 90 minutes, but the lack of response to going behind, the lack of urgency or plan B that they offered once they had gone behind. And when we're talking about Ipswich, for example, and how they've come from behind and how they managed to get points, this Leicester team, they don't seem to have different gears even when they're losing. The game state doesn't seem to affect the urgency of which they play, which is obviously not ideal, and you wouldn't fancy Leicester to come from behind and pick up points in the same way that Ipswich have. That said, they then played Norwich, went 1-0 down from the Liverpool corner, the Manchester City corner routine, which John Stone scored from a couple of weeks ago with Gabriel Sara nipping in at the front post. And they did come from behind, and they got level pretty quickly through Keane and Dewsbury Hall, and they were very good value, I thought, against Norwich. I was a bit disappointed with Norwich. They didn't really lay a glove on them to say they'd gone in front. And I think they paid them almost too much respect, despite leading 1-0. And once it went to 1-1, you were waiting for the second for them to get in front. It's a brilliant bit of individual play from Mavididi to lift the ball over the defender's leg and then curl it into the bottom corner. So Leicester, a bad, obviously, start to the weekend. A lot of question marks over whether they were really going to fall apart. But I thought they responded in a really positive way on Monday.
Absolutely. And this was a game, after what had happened on Friday at Ashton Gate, that they had to win. They really did have to win this one, because that defeat at Bristol City, of course, meant that they'd lost 4 in 6, one win in that run. That was relegation standard form, to be fair. But they've now responded without winning Norwich, and suddenly you look at their last four games and they've taken 7 points from 12, which is, it's not brilliant, but it's not too bad. But I look at Leicester's...
It's a small sample size.
Yeah, I look at Leicester's next few games though, and I look at them and I think this is a good opportunity to get some points, get back in first gear and really, really go for it. They've got Birmingham at home this weekend, then back-to-back away trips. Bearing in mind, we've got a full midweek slate next week as well. Millwall on Tuesday night.
Wednesday night away in Bristol.
Oh, just what you want. Millwall away Tuesday night, and then Plymouth away next Friday night. So a big old week for Leicester coming up against three teams that are obviously down at the other end of the table who are far from safe themselves as of yet. So Leicester will be looking at that and thinking, we've got an opportunity, though these three teams are going to be fired up and needing the points just as much as we are. We've got an opportunity to put a bit of a marker down as we head into the final four games. Of course, Leicester have got seven games left compared to the six Ipswich and Leeds have. Leicester, though, in April, back end of April, should I say, a couple of toughies potentially. West Brom and Southampton at home back-to-back in the space of 4 days. Not easy. Southampton, West Brom potentially, like you said with Southampton, maybe going to be on the beach at that point, preparing for the playoffs. So we'll see on that one. Then they've got Preston away and then Blackburn at home on the final day. And who knows what Blackburn could be playing for? Who knows if Preston could still be in the playoff race by the time we get to the 27th of April? So it's not an easy run for Enzo Maresca's side, but it's certainly favourable. But ultimately, that win over Norwich, I didn't see the game, but I read reports that Norwich, after getting the nose in front, offered very, very, very little. I've seen the highlights. And ultimately, Leicester did look quite good. They looked sharp in and around the box. Keenan Jewsbury Hall getting the first goal. Mavadidi, like you said, with a brilliant one for the second. Then Vardy off the bench to make the point safe late on. So it was a big win for Leicester and one that they needed. Won two of the last four now. Excuse me. But they look like a team that obviously have got a lot going on in the background with all this off-field stuff that they can't control. And the best way they can take the focus off that now is by playing the stuff that they've done for the bulk of the season. Yes, they've had a bit of a rough patch in the last few weeks. But if you were to talk about the duration of the season, Leicester would deserve it because they've been top, they were top, should I say, for God knows how long. But ultimately, they're up against two teams here that, at the moment, in terms of sort of the last 10 games, are in better form than them.
I don't think realistically, but of those three teams, you could argue that any of them, whoever wins it, deserves it with the points tally.
Funnily enough, I was actually thinking about this earlier on because I knew obviously we'd be discussing this evening. And I sort of said to myself, at this point in the season, there's three teams fighting for two places and people are going to have their own opinions. They're going to argue about it, about which two, no, you're wrong, this is right, blah, blah, blah. I don't think there is a wrong answer at this point.
How can there be? They're all going to amass 90 plus points.
Exactly. They're all going to get 90 plus. There's no doubt about it. I don't think there is a wrong answer.
No.
So like I said earlier on, I'm still going to stick by my guns and what I said last week's episode and go with Leeds and Ipswich to top the top two places. Are you still sticking with Leeds and Leicester for your choice?
I think so. I don't think I'm going to change. No matter what, I don't think I'm prepared to change again when there's only six games left to go. That's what I think.
This is the thing. I can't sort of argue with your choice because it's got substance to it. It's fully respectable. There's no argument to be had.
Wow. I have made a point that's got substance on it. Fully respectable.
I agree. I just don't. I don't think anybody at this point can sort of say for example, what the hell are you on about? They've got no chance. There's no way you can argue that because all three teams have set an electric pace. Ipswich, I think, just to have kept up with these and now lead the two of them, have done a phenomenal job, bearing in mind where they were last year, fighting to get out of League One. Whereas Leeds and Leicester obviously have come down from the Premier League. Leicester, let's not forget, were Premier League champions only 8 years ago. So for Ipswich to have done what they've done is phenomenal. I, for one, with no sort of allegiance to the top of the table, no real preference, I'm just looking forward to these final three or four weeks that we've got left. The season finished exactly a month today by the date. It's going to be one hell of a ride to the finish line, but let's just see what that game in hand for Leicester ultimately, could it mean something? Because if Leicester win those seven games, they do win the title, of course. So we've seen Leicester many times this season put a strong run of results together. Ipswich, though, 9 wins in 10. Leeds still unbeaten in 2024. Goodness me, what a race. For all them months of thinking Leicester were home and hose, thinking there was no title race to be had. And after Leeds beat Leicester at the end of February, we were all, oh, we've got two going for it now. Everybody Nearly everybody dismissed Ipswich, and I said, do not count them out yet. And look what they've done. I, for one, I couldn't call it. I genuinely couldn't call it. It's going to be some bloody finish, this.
Yeah, and Leeds, of course, took 4 points over the Easter weekend. Again, they were hard fought. They didn't have it their own way. They were probably a little bit fortunate to get a point at Watford. They certainly were second best for most of that game, and Farker certainly admitted that they struggled after the international break. They got a few injuries. I think breaking up the partnership of Ampadu and Joe Rodon at centre-back was something that didn't work out. They were struggling at full-back, so Cooper came in. He went into midfield. Gruev's obviously been out for the last couple of games, but he restored that partnership against Hull. I thought Hull were decent value to get themselves level, but two moments of quality with Somerville to win the penalty and then shrug off Joel Peru and roll the ball down the middle of the goal. And then Dan James on the angle just inside the Hull City half to fire in a goal for 3-1. Got them the points. I do just want to say props to Watford and Tom Cleverley, because we're probably not going to talk about Watford too much on this pod. But to go and get a point against Leeds, to go and get a point at West Brom and have been 2-0 up, I think he's shown two very good game plans in those games of how to cause problems for the opposition. And I don't think the games that either Daniel Farker or Carlos Corberan will have enjoyed playing in. So props to Watford. And yeah, we're going to have a fantastic end to the season with those four teams, well, those three teams, as we're now calling it, going for automatic promotion. George, let's switch our attention to the bottom of the Championship now. And there is only one big winner of the Championship weekend at the bottom, and that is Queen's Park Rangers. Marty Cifuentes, baby. That's the tune. And it's been the most remarkable weekend to be a Queen's Park Rangers defender, because I think we've all played amateur football, but we've not all... And we've all had the dreams where we chest the ball down in the 90th minute and smash one in with our opposite foot over the goalkeeper. And Jimmy Dunn lived that dream. An unbelievable moment, as someone that's been part of this QPR revival, for him to bring the ball down, chest trap, in a massive game that you were losing in against a relegation rival, and to spank into the top corner. Unbelievable. And then Steve Cook must have been watching behind and went, you know what, I fancy a bit of that. So he they go to Swansea, it's 0-0. And he, Robin Van Persie-esque, volleys it into the far corner. And that's a 1-0 win at Swansea. And that is QPR all but safe, in my opinion. They've not got enough points. If they lost every game between now and the end of the season, they could still go down. But there's just no way they don't pick up the 4 points or so that they need to guarantee safety in these last six games. And the job that Marty Cifuentes has done is phenomenal. Let me remind you that QPR had 8 points from 14 games under Gareth Ainsworth when Marty Cifuentes was appointed. If the season had started that date, QPR would be ninth. They have conceded less than one goal per game on average under Cifuentes. And if you look at their underlying numbers, they basically got the second best defence in the league. They're up there with West Brom. They're up there with Leeds United. And for me, in my opinion, there is no doubt Marty Cifuentes should be on the shortlist to be manager of the season. I don't care that QPR are still mathematically not safe. He should be there. Because even if they somehow manage to go down at this point, it does not dismiss from the job he has done. To take over a squad that was so disjointed and so bereft of confidence and lacking any sort of organisation. You know, I went to QPR at the end of September. Start of October, sorry, and Blackburn won 4-0 there, and QPR were bloody awful. They looked terrible. They got a few players out, but the way he's galvanised and brought that group together, given them a discernible style of play, brought Chris Willock back into it, he's just got the best out of what he's got, which is not that much, really. They are not that much better than a bottom five squad. And to produce the goods that he has, I think he, in my opinion, certainly should be on the podium for manager of the season.
I can't disagree with anything you've just said. It's been a remarkable transformation and most certainly, as you said, quite worthy of the title of being the biggest winners of the Easter weekend at the bottom, 6 points out of six. And two performances that required a lot of battling, a lot of courage, a lot of energy. And boy, did they deliver it. And you look at QPR now, it's one loss in the last seven league games now, I think it is. Last eight league games, in fact. They've won five in that run. And quite rightly, as you just said, they've taken the 9th highest number of points since Marty Cifuentes got the job on the 30th of October. It's been quite remarkable. Only Leeds have conceded fewer goals since he took that job. 25 QPR of ship, which is the identical record to West Brom. And everybody so often raves about the defensive record of a Carlos Corberan team. Marty Cifuentes has done a remarkable job. And neither of us have mentioned it yet by name, but Marty Cifuentes would have been a much, much stronger shout for a place on the manager of the season shortlist than Liam Rossignol.
We're going to come to that. We're going to talk about Hull later.
We are going to discuss that. But Marty Cifuentes would have been a far, far better option to go on that list. And you said to me privately last night that if Danny Rull keeps Wednesday up, he's probably a worthy candidate as well. And we'll discuss Wednesday shortly too. But QPR, the transformation's been unbelievable. And I worked out another stat yesterday, which went live on the podcast social media page this morning, that I didn't realise till discovering it, of course, that only Leeds and Ipswich have kept more clean sheets away from home this season than QPR now. 7 clean sheets on the road. That's pretty solid. But it's not just the way that Marty Cifuentes has come in and sort of acted as the firefighter and getting results on the board. The style of play has been transformed. They've been excellent to watch. The last time I watched QPR on TV was when they drew 2-2 with West Bromwich Albion last month, at the very beginning of last month. And they were excellent that night. They should have won the game. They were absolutely superb. And ultimately, when you look at their recent results, they've gone to Leicester and won. They've beaten Birmingham, who were obviously going to be fueled by the appointment of a new manager. They went to Swansea and won, who have been improving themselves recently. They got a point off West Brom, should have beaten them. They went to Bristol City, who have got the ability to spring a surprise and beat anybody on the day, and then lose, say, to the lesser teams. They've not had an easy batch of fixtures in the last few weeks. And I think what's all the more impressive with QPR, the way that they've pulled clear now and opened up that 6-point gap. And like you said, even though it's not mathematical that they're safe yet, far from it, I do sort of think they have got the job done now. They're only 5 points behind Sunderland now. They're closer to them, who I think are 11th off the top of my head, than say to Huddersfield Town, who are 22nd. But when you look back at QPR, they had a really rough ride over Christmas and at the start of January. They had a difficult time. Because you think back to it, the 13th of December, they drew 0-0 with Plymouth. And before that, beaten Hull 4 days before. They didn't win again until the 20th of January. So they went on about a 6-7 game winless run over Christmas, which is obviously a key point in the season. And at that point, I sort of looked and I thought, they're going to be in trouble here. They're not getting the points of the board. Because at that point, Wednesday was sort of getting a real lot of momentum behind them. They looked like the most likely to escape. And now QPR, they could easily achieve a top half finish. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. Got a big game this weekend against Sheffield Wednesday. Then they've got to play Plymouth. Beyond that, they've got some potential tricky ones. But being honest, on current form at the moment, QPR are probably one of the last teams that I'd want to play at the minute because they've got so much belief about them, so much confidence. And you've already done it justice and given it enough praise. But I've got to agree with you. That Jimmy Dunn goal against Birmingham last week, goodness me, what a strike that was. That's got to be a contender for the goal of the season shortly, surely. Absolute beauty from him. And Steve Cook's at Swansea wasn't too shabby either. But ultimately, you paid homage to Marty Cifuentes, but I've got to echo every word you said. He's done a remarkable job. And, you know, with a little bit of funding next season and the chance to implement his own player, bring his own players in, this, that and the other, QPR could have a happy year next year, because I think any threat of relegation now is well and truly over. Though, of course, the mathematics say otherwise until it's official. But I just can't see QPR getting sucked into any immediate danger again. Job's
looking
done,
at those around them, it was a good weekend for Stoke City. They took 4 points, a big win on Good Friday against Hull City in particular. Massive, massive win for Blackburn Rovers. They won 5-1 at Sunderland, having played pretty well in recent games against Middlesbrough and Ipswich, where they didn't score, drawing 0-0 and losing 1-0. They've been banging on the ketchup bottle in the last three games, and it all exploded and all came out on Easter Monday. They were fantastic.
I've never heard anybody use that phrase to analyse football.
You've clearly not read any of my articles this week, because it's probably the third time I've made that analogy.
Banging on the ketchup bottle.
Yeah, so I don't actually eat ketchup, but hypothetically, it gets it gets jammed, doesn't it? You've got to slap the bottle to try and get it to come out.
Yeah.
It gets jammed. And they've been battering the bottle. I hope this analogy doesn't get taken out of context, but they've been battering the bottle to try and get everything to come out. And it didn't happen at Middlesbrough. It didn't happen against Ipswich. And then it's all exploded out at the Stadium of Light all over Sunderland.
I think the most impressive element of that Blackburn win wasn't the fact that they actually won a game. There was someone else other than Sammy Smonics actually scored a goal.
Well, they were 2-0 up by the time that happened, in fairness. So.
I know. As soon as they went 2-0 up and Smonics scored again, I thought, is there anybody other than that lad that can score a goal for that football club? And then someone else did.
Remarkably.
Yeah, and then Tyree Stolen had a go.
Remarkably, it was actually the first time that the front four of Sam Gallagher, Sam Smodics, Ryan Hedges and Tyree Stolen had played together this season. And that was the front four that inspired their very impressive four-game winning run last season, where they beat Leicester in the FA Cup when they were a Premier League side, beat Sheffield United and got them right in the playoff battle. And because of injuries, Gallagher's obviously been out for a long time, Hedges has been out for a long time. It's the first time, as a front four, they've all played together. They scored five goals and they were generally unplayable. And Birmingham, of course, are off the mark under Gary Rowett, beating Preston 1-0. So some big winners for the weekend. Who do you think of those sort of teams that we've just discussed? Who was it most important for?
I think it was important for all of them, but I think the four-point haul for Stoke was particularly key. And a lot of people
be a bit disappointed not to beat Huddersfield at home.
That's the thing. That was where I was going to lead to, in the sense that if you flip those results around and they'd drawn at Hull and beaten Huddersfield, you probably would have been sort of very, very appreciative of that. Hull, of course, have been very poor at home in recent months. Let's not escape that fact. But still, for Stoke to have gone there and won was a really impressive result. Huddersfield, I didn't see the game on Monday afternoon, even though it was televised. I didn't watch it. But I gather that Stoke were the better team in the second half and were doing a lot of knocking on the door in pursuit of a second goal.
Cracking goal from Kiana Hoover.
Yes, and Huddersfield's from Raovic wasn't bad either. That was a really good finish too. Two excellent goals in that game. And Lewis Baker in the first half, desperately unlucky, what would have been a very, very good free kick. But I think for Steven Schumacher, it's 4 points from six over Easter. It's a good haul. It's positive. It's uplifting. It opens up a little bit of a gap. Of course, nothing, like in the case of QPR at the moment, nothing's mathematical certainty yet, but a five-point gap just gives you that little bit of leeway and a bit of extra breathing space. So I think Stoke were probably the biggest winners, like beneath QPR of the weekend, in terms of those teams at the bottom. Blackburn, of course, they just had to win somehow. It didn't matter how it comes. So to have won 5-1 away from home, really, really impressive result. And that should only inject confidence ahead of these final six
four
games.
Four goals in six games before.
I know. Then football, isn't it? It's just, that's the championship all over. So I think, obviously, Blackburn, Stoke, good weekend. Birmingham as well, 3 points from six. I think they would have accepted that at the start. QPR was always going to be tricky.
Particularly how gut-wrenching that Jimmy Dunn goal would have been. So to come back.
And to be fair, Preston was never going to be an easy game either on Easter Monday, because Preston, by all accounts, played well in that game. And obviously, games can change on goals, and who knows how things would have panned after that.
But slips as last man.
That's what I was just going to say. If Liam Lindsay doesn't slip, does that game finish 0-0? Does Preston win it 1-0? We'll never know. But Jay Stansfield took the opportunity that presented itself.
Great,
and just
time with that finish.
He did. It seemed to take an age for him to get to the penalty area. Yeah. And Jay Stansfield, of course, now up to 10 championship goals for the season, 11 in all competitions. He's been a really successful loan signing this year, probably one of the most sort of understated, sort of outside of the Birmingham supporters across the league, as a like everybody else looking from the outside looking in. He's done a lot better than probably a lot of people have given him credit for from other clubs. Really good signing. And Gary Rowett, I said it last week, it just feels like a sensible fit for the job that needs to be done in these next few weeks. And that might spur them on. Plymouth, obviously, just really difficult weekend. Sheffield Wednesday, not much better. Huddersfield, the same. Millwall, not great either. Not the worst result in the world to get a point off West Brom, but to then lose to Rotherham.
Well,
that is a real kick in the teeth.
We've done good weekend four. Let's do bad weekend four. Plymouth Argyle, as we've touched on, obviously, losing both games, sacking Ian Foster. Bad weekend. Sheffield Wednesday, 1 point and well beaten. They were, at one point, when they were beating Swansea on Good Friday, they were coming out of the relegation zone for the first time since September. However, they then dropped points in very upsetting circumstances for them, a bit of controversy with the handball, perhaps for Jamal Lowe. And then they were just battered at Middlesbrough, weren't good enough. Some very harsh words from Daddy Real after the game about their survival hopes. A lot of people probably maybe writing Wednesday off at this point because obviously they were beaten 6-0 by Ipswich. They've then dropped points at home to Swansea and it's the home form that's really sparked this revival and then to get soundly beaten at Middlesbrough. But what I would just say to that is Wednesday had been in this sort of situation before. They got thumped 4-0 at Huddersfield and were 8 points adrift. And then they went and won 4 games out of 5. Now they play QPR this weekend and that is simply... I'm not sure it's must win, but it's must not lose, in my opinion, for Sheffield Wednesday. They need to get something on the board to build some momentum as much as anything.
Wednesday have got a huge week, absolutely massive week. They've got QPR away on Saturday, as you've quite rightly said there. Then they've got Norwich at home next Tuesday evening. And then they've got Stoke City at home next Saturday. So two enormous home games.
But it's not out of the realms of possibility to say they get 6 points.
No, it's not. It's not. And I was at the Swansea game on Good Friday and Wednesday should have won that game. They were the better team over the course of the 90 minutes. I mean, they couldn't get a kick of the ball in the first half, but they went into the lead 1-0 up. Went into the break 1-0 up, should I say, through a Bailey Cadamartri goal. And a lot of people inside the ground were sort of getting on Wednesday's backs. They were sort of not attacking in the way that they had under Danny Rill. That was because they were trying to limit Swansea's ability with the ball by being quite compact and creating a shape for the middle where Swansea couldn't play through them. And Wednesday ultimately led at the break. They had a lorry load of chances after half-time. EK Ugbo smashed one off the bar. Paul Valentin dragged one wide. Marvin Johnson dragged one wide. Jeddy Gassama had a great chance. They, on another day, Wednesday could have won that game 3 or 4-1. There's no doubt about it. They did play well. Middlesbrough, literally 72 hours later, it was the worst performance of the Danny Rill era. It was even worse than the 6-0 Ipswich.
We have seen a big drop-off, haven't we, in performances when Wednesday have had to play more than one game a week.
Yes, we have. And this is the sign of, obviously, a squad that is ageing. There's no denying that. It is an ageing squad. And ultimately, and let's not forget people listening to this who may be Wednesday fans. We are both Owl supporters. We're both Wednesday fans. And there is no denying that whatever league Wednesday are in come next season, that squad needs gutting and starting again. There's an absolute lorry load of players out of contract. Danny Rill, Barry Bannon have been talking about it in today's press conference, Thursday's press conference. And there is a lot of work to be done. Danny Rill was clearly brought in for the long term and he has done a good job. When you consider where Wednesday were when he picked up the baton, it took them 14 games to get their first win. The fact that they're only 2 points from safety with 6 games to go is a miracle in itself, to be fair. And like you said, people will write Wednesday off now. I've got my doubts myself, but there's still a chance. They could win at the weekend, results go the way, and they're out of the bottom three. But the one thing that you've mentioned there quite rightly, the bulk of Wednesday's improvement under Danny Rill has been at home. They've got 3 home games left. Norwich, Stoke City, West Brom. Two, obviously, really, really tough opponents striving for promotion.
I don't know what state West Brom will be in on the final, though.
That's the course. 27th of April, that one. Penultimate round of fixtures. Yeah. Wednesday's last home game. But I think the one crumb of comfort I take from Wednesday is, generally speaking, they have been better at home than they've been away. So if they can muster, say, 7 points from 9 from those last 3 home games, it's going to take a hell of an effort. There's no denying that. But if they can do it, and we've seen they're capable of it, like you said, they've bounced back from setbacks before. They've got a chance. But quite interestingly is Wednesday's home form over the course of the last 6 games, and this statistic did surprise me, over the last 6 home matches, only Leeds have conceded fewer goals at home than Wednesday over the last 6. Wednesday have only conceded 4. Leeds have conceded 2. So they've not been bad at home. But I just think, how much of a reaction are these players going to produce at QPR at the weekend? Because you're of the opinion where it's kind of a must-not-lose game. I think for me, purely for the angle of supporters with mounting frustrations, I think it's a game they've got to win. But being brutally honest, I just can't see it. I just think QPR have got so much going for them in the minute that I can't see past a home victory, unfortunately, for Wednesday. So it's certainly not over yet, no doubt about it. But this next week does feel like it's going to be 7 days that does make or break Wednesday's survival chances. We move into the final three, because that's the thing. Come next Saturday evening, the 13th of April, we will be 3 games from the finish line. We will be very nearly there. massive week ahead for so many clubs.
Yeah, mental to think there'll be four games left when we next record. Again, another two-game week coming up. Bad weekend for Millwall as well, just getting 1 point. They were winning against West Brom, but were pegged back. And then to lose at Rotherham who could have been relegated, but they've held that off for another week. We'll obviously do an obituary on Rotherham when they are confirmed. 18 points available, 18 points adrift, but they would have to overturn 39 goal difference in that time. So
I'm going to stick my neck on the line here, and I'm going to say that I think they're gone. Yeah, I think it's done.
Some games to keep an eye out this weekend, as we say, QPR v Sheffield Wednesday, Rotherham v Plymouth, and Huddersfield versus Millwall. The relegation picture is going to change a lot in the next 5 days or so, which I'm very excited about. If we were playing good weekend four, bad weekend four in the Championship relegation battle, we're just going to play bad weekend four and bad weekend four in the battle to get sixth place, because it was very weird and nobody took advantage of everyone else being quite poor. Hull probably had arguably the worst weekend, losing both games. No shame really in losing at Leeds United and played well for large portions. But to lose at home to Stoke is obviously a majorly disappointing result. And there's been a lot of interesting discourse, I think, around Hull City in the last sort of 48 hours. They are currently 10th in the league. They're no win in six, and their hopes of finishing the playoffs have obviously took a massive dent with recent results. Liam Rossini's had a lot of criticism from internal supporters, but also from some of the wider media, especially when he was nominated for Manager of the Season by the EFL. Now, just to be clear, I don't think for 1 second that Liam Rossini has been one of the top three managers in the Championship this season. However, I also don't think it's quite as easy as saying, look what they've spent, they've underachieved. Because I think you've got to also respect that when Liam Rossini took over Hull City, they were, you know, entrenched in a relegation battle. They were in the bottom half. They were, what, something like 19th? And it's not as simple as chucking a load of quality players in and expecting a big turnaround. That you've got to glue these players together. You've got to fit them into a philosophy. You've got to get them up to speed. And I actually think they probably overindulged in the January window, where they almost, you know, the old adage is too many cooks spoils the broth. And I think adding Carvalho, Zaruri, on top of Philogene, on top of Toufan, I think it probably was a little bit too much. You've got a lot of players there that favour sort of the left-hand side in that attack as well. You've got Philogene, who wants to play on the left. You've got Zaruri, who wants to play on the left. Carvalho generally moves into that left channel, be it in central areas. And I'm not sure it's been quite as balanced post-January as you would like when you look at the names on paper and suggest that they've underachieved. So I'm not necessarily buying into that. However, I do have to also agree he shouldn't have been on the Manager of the Season shortlist. I think Marty Cifuentes, Danny Rill, Carlos Corberan would all be more suitable names, in my opinion. But there's no doubt Liam Rossini's been heavily backed. There's no doubt it's a very expensive and talented squad he's got. But I don't think it's quite as simple as saying he's underachieved because they're not in the playoffs because of the players they brought in.
No, I agree with all of that, to be fair. And we've both said countless times on this podcast ever since he got the job that we're both very, very, very fond of Liam Rossini. Personally, I think he's one of the most likable managers in the division. I don't think there's anything to dislike about him, really. He speaks well, comes across very well, talks a good game. And yeah, ultimately, any manager, whoever they are, whatever club they're at, is judged on results. There's no doubt about that. And like you said, it's an expensive assembled team. They have brought a lot of big names in that are going to be on big wages in terms of sort of loanees, like Anas Zaruri, Tyler Morton, for example, Liam Delap. Obviously, he's been injured for quite a while now. But he certainly isn't worthy of a spot on this. His three-man shortlist for the Manager of the Season award, there's no doubt about it. Because you look at it, Hull City have only won three games more than they've actually lost, which is hugely surprising, to be fair. So I think you've got to look at it and accept that Hull, yeah, they've got a decent team. Is it going to be underachievement if they don't get in the top six? Personally, I think you can look at it two ways, in the sense that, yes, they've spent a lot of money to bring these players in, but at the same time, you've still got to bet it all in, and you're still up against teams that I would argue are at the start of the season were stronger set up to get into the playoff places. And you mentioned a few names there that were arguably more worthy of a position on this shortlist, such as Marty Cifuentes. I think another name that would have been more worthy for the turnaround is David Wagner at Norwich City, to be fair to him, because he looked as though he was on the brink of losing his job when they lost at home to Blackburn Rovers, for example, back in November. I think it was Bonfire Night. Then they go to Cardiff and complete that 3-2 comeback. And ultimately, that's the turning point in their season. Norwich now have won the same amount of games as West Bromwich Albion this season. They've won three games more than Hull. Even Middlesbrough have won more games than Hull this season. Cardiff as well under Errol Bullitt. So Liam Rossiniere, for me, as much as I like him, and I think over the course of his whole tenure, he's done a good job in terms of bringing them forward and developing them, I just don't see how he's made this shortlist. I think there's many, many candidates that were more worthy of it who are, say, further down the tail. Marty Cifuentes being a prime example. So it's a very, very peculiar one. And I actually saw the shortlist about an hour after it had actually come out, because I was out and about, I was driving, and I stopped and I saw it. I thought, Liam Rossiniere, manager of the season. I thought, what has he done to be worthy of that? Kieran McKenna, fully justified. Daniel Farke, the same. I expected Enzo Maresca's name to be on there, to be fair. But Liam Rossiniere, as much as I like him, and I think he's done a good job over the course of his tenure at Hull, I do not understand this one at all. It's very, very odd. But ultimately, they've made the decision. He's on the shortlist. And as for Hull as a collective, disastrous weekend over Easter. Admittedly, very tough fixture on Easter Monday. And to be fair, they did play quite well against Leeds. They made life difficult for them. I watched the game in full. But 6 points adrift at the playoffs now. Do have a game in hand on Norwich. But it's going to be a tall order because of the form that they're in. Their home form has been so poor in the last few months. I just can't see it myself. I think that sort of sixth place battle, that final playoff spot, is a straight shootout still between Norwich and Coventry, though you can't dismiss Preston and Middlesbrough. Obviously, Preston getting 3 points over Easter, Middlesbrough getting 4 points, Hull, of course, with nothing. But for Coventry, I mean, that defeat to Cardiff after Norwich lost earlier in the day on Monday, that was a real kick in the teeth for them, because I think Coventry have missed a massive opportunity there to eat into Norwich's advantage. For me, I thought of all the Easter Monday fixtures we had, Coventry winning was the most certain result. So it just goes to show what the Championship can do.
Yeah, I think if you're Coventry or Preston, you're looking at that and thinking you've missed a massive chance on Easter Monday, because both of them have dropped points in games they would hope not to. We do also have to say Cardiff's goals are two of the funnier goals you'll likely to see. A bad, bad afternoon if your name is Liam Kitching. The first one, he's just kicked it into his own net. If that was in the Paraguayan second division, you would be arguing there could be some match fixing going on.
Can I be honest?
Half-volleyed the ball into the top corner.
I didn't actually catch up on the Easter Monday highlights till this morning being Thursday morning. And I watched the Coventry Cardiff highlights. I actually had to press pause and rewind for that first own goal to double check what I'd just seen, because I thought, surely, I know he's got a player of a Cardiff persuasion about to pounce, but I thought he's just leathered that into his own net like he's generally meant to do it. It was just like, what is he doing?
The second one was very unfortunate. Like, we would be suggesting match fixing had gone on.
But yeah, I mean, it was a but ultimately for Coventry, though, disappointing result. That was one.
Second one's quite unlucky as well, and that's where I say
it is. Very unfortunate.
I don't want to overanalyze this defeat from Coventry, because they have conceded two absolute freak goals.
And let's just be honest, in a sort of a show of solidarity to Liam Kitching, he has been immense this season with Bobby Thomas at the back for Coventry. He is entitled to the odd mistake. But
I'm not sure he's entitled to volley the ball into the back of his own net.
That first own goal was a little bit dodgy. I think we can agree. A bit different, put it that way.
Yeah, Norwich picked up one win, as we've discussed. Middlesbrough, I don't think they're back in the conversation personally, because they've got a game in hand on some teams, but they haven't got one on Norwich, and they're still 6 points behind.
They haven't got a game in hand on anybody. Middlesbrough.
Have they not? Okay, well, even less so. Nope.
Preston, Coventry have games in hand on them.
Well, I got that the wrong way around then. They've played more games. I think what I meant to say is they played the same amount of games as Norwich,
Yeah, that's correct.
Behind them, and they've got the obviously Preston and Coventry have got games in hand. So I'm not putting them back in the conversation, but a 4-point haul was very impressive. And West Brom could have been squeaky bum time from them a little bit because they only picked up 2 points, but nobody below them took advantage. If anyone else had picked up 6, we might have been having a conversation, but West Brom pretty comfy still in 5th place.
Yeah. Just on Middlesbrough, though, the next sort of 4 or 5 days feel really crucial for them. Swansea at home this weekend, that's a winnable game. Then they've got Hull away next Wednesday night. And depending on how the weekend goes for both teams and those in and around, that could be
all 6 games, really.
And then after that, they've got Ipswich and Leeds back-to-back, which does kind of crank up the difficulty level. But then the last 2 games, they've got Cardiff away, Watford at home. So it's not an easy run. They've not got any of the teams in danger. I think it's unlikely. I'm personally sticking with my prediction of Coventry. I still think they've got it in them, but it just potentially depends how big a distraction this FA Cup semi-final could be.
It's a little bit pointless, isn't it? Because ultimately, whoever doesn't... I know it's not because this is the Championship and playoff football in particular doesn't work.
You should know after the playoffs last year, anything could happen.
It does feel like a big drop-off from 5th to the teams that are competing for 6th. And especially when you've got the quality of the top 3. So whoever doesn't finish in the top 2 is going to be massive favourites. And unless it's something like an Ipswich Norwich, where form would then go out the window a little bit because it's a derby, or unless Leicester are 3rd, where you think, how are they going to cope with that mentality shift and that disappointment? Whoever finishes 6th, they're just not at the levels of the other 3 teams, in my opinion.
It's really, really hard to call. And this is the thing, we're at a point now where we are exactly a month away from the finish line. And we're still no closer to knowing anything apart from that Rotherham are going to finish bottom of the pile. Apart from that, we know nothing. We know who the top 3 are going to be. Otherwise, we haven't got a clue. Same with the battle for 22nd and 23rd to avoid those 2 spots. A lot of people will lean towards Sheffield Wednesday and Huddersfield now. There's no mathematical certainty that will happen. So I just think this playoff battle, personally, I think Middlesbrough, Hull, still in it, but got a lot of work to do and going to rely on a lot of help.
I don't think Middlesbrough.
Well, they're on equal points.
Yeah, but Hull have got
game in hand. Hull have a game in hand on both.
Yeah, but a game in hand's a lot. With 6 games to go, a game in hand is significant.
Yeah, it is, but you've got to make the most of them. That's the thing. You've always got to make the most of game in hands, and we've seen that countless times with so many clubs down the years.
Also still got
they only count for something if you win them. Yeah, and Coventry have got Leeds this weekend. So big, big game, that one. That is a huge one on Saturday afternoon. So I still get the feeling that Coventry might edge it. They've got that game in hand on Norwich. Obviously got to make the most of it, but have still got to play Southampton away from home. There's some tough games coming up for everybody. There's no easy run. Norwich, on paper, probably have the easiest set of fixtures left. But a big game with Ipswich this weekend. Then they've got Sheffield Wednesday next Tuesday, who are obviously going to be fighting for every nut and cranny they can get now. There's no guarantees at this point in the season, but personally, I think Norwich and Coventry are going to scrap tooth and nail for that last spot, but I wouldn't dismiss Preston just yet. The other two, Middlesbrough Hull, got a chance, but probably less likely.
Yeah, and it's all going to be fascinating to see how it unfolds.
It certainly is.
Next time we record, we'll be down to 4 games, so we'll be back next Friday morning to recap all of the weekend action, but a particular focus on those midweek games, which are coming at you Tuesday and Wednesday night. But that marks the end of this week's Championship Chat podcast. Thank you for listening. Make sure you are subscribed to this podcast feed, wherever you get your pods from, and make sure you never miss an episode, and follow us on Twitter at ChampChatPod24. And a massive thank you, as always, to our sponsors, Cards Accepted, for supporting the podcast this season. If you're looking to take card payments with no contract or monthly fees, make sure you go and check them out at cardsaccepted.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you again next week for another episode of the Championship Chat podcast.
This is the Championship Chat podcast, your home of news, views, and debate from England's second tier.